be around the world. And thank you for joining us once again on truth2u.org. That's truth number two, letter u.org. It's season two of Torah Pals. I'm Jono, and joining me in the virtual Truth to You studio all the way from Ireland is Jason of spiritualbabies.net. G'day, mate.
G'day. Good morning, everybody.
Good morning. And joining us all the way from Sumatra, Indonesia today is the author of Let's Get Biblical, Why Doesn't Judaism Accept the Christian Messiah, volumes 1 and 2, right on my desk. I have them right here all the time, always within reach, because I'm always reaching for them. If you don't have a copy of them, dear listeners, you need to get it. You can get copies from his website, which is outreachjudaism.org. That's outreachjudaism.org. Welcome back to the program, Rabbi Tovia Singer.
Hey, great to be here with you.
Wonderful to have you, my friend. And today, of course, Vayechel. And that's from Exodus chapter 35, verse 1 to 38, 20. Tovia, it begins this way. It says, "Then Moses gathered all the congregation of the children of Israel together and said to them, 'These are the words which the Lord has commanded you to do. Work shall be done for 6 days, but the seventh day shall be a holy day for you, a Sabbath rest to the Lord. Whoever does any work on it shall be put to death. You shall kindle no fire throughout your dwellings on the Sabbath day.'" We have to stop there and talk about that, because books have been written just on those verses there, Tovia. And there's a lot of question marks when it comes to the third verse. What does it mean that you can't kindle? What if you live? I mean, just recently we saw in Jerusalem, it was snowing. There was a whole lot of snow. What do you mean? I can't have a fire. I'm going to be cold. What does it mean?
There's so many delicious layers in this passage. And that is that there were some heterodox movements that said that, you know what, because Jewish people were not allowed to on the Sabbath have a flame, so therefore we're not allowed to enjoy the flame and we're not to have any benefit from the flame at all. But in fact, the text here, the term Lo Sevaru Eish B'chol Moshposechem, there's so many reasons it's in here, so I want to break this into two parts. Number one, Shabbos is different than a festival, because a festival we are allowed to use fire and actually to cook. We find that earlier on in this book of Exodus, in Exodus chapter 12, where we're told we can enjoy for our own thing, and so we can cook. Shabbos is different. You're not allowed to cook on the Shabbos day, but the language Lo Sevaru Eish B'chol Moshposechem is very specific, and that is, it doesn't mean you're not allowed to enjoy a fire, you're not allowed to enjoy the light that fire provides, you're not allowed to enjoy the warmth that fire provides. What you're not allowed to do is to ignite a fire, to begin a fire, to start a fire on the Shabbos day, because in so doing, you are performing a melacha, you are igniting a fire. So therefore, what the Jewish people do to you know, we always want to celebrate our relation with Hashem in every tone of the text. Is we of course never kindle a fire on Shabbos, but we do want to enjoy the light of the fire. So there is a rabbinic tradition to light the Sabbath candles on the Shabbos day, before the Shabbos begins, and then to enjoy that light during the Shabbos on Friday night. Another very ancient custom is to make cholent. Now, that's a food, a stew. Did either of you ever eat cholent?
I don't believe I have. You have, Jason?
Yeah. It's like it's in a big crock pot.
Yeah. So it's like that.
Love my crock
that's
pot.
That's my favorite food in the world. Sushi and pastrami get behind cholent, but it has to be made properly. I'm not going to give out the recipe now because it's a big show, but there is a recipe that will knock your socks off. Anyways, so what cholent is, it's a warm food that we start cooking it before Shabbos starts. The fire stays on, and we eat it Shabbos afternoon to emphasize this passage, to enjoy a nice hot meat meal on Shabbos. But we did not kindle, we did not ignite the flame on the Sabbath day.
I just want to get this straight. So if I have like a slow combustion heater and it's burning away in the winter there in Jerusalem, it's snowing outside, it's beautiful, and it's Friday afternoon. If I stack it full of wood and I turn down that little knob that lets the air in, it burns slowly, and
What are you talking? You're talking to a kid who grew up in Brooklyn. You don't talk about letting air in.
What do you mean you're snowing?
I don't know what letting air in. We just turn on a heater.
Okay. Anyway.
I know you grew up on Gilligan's Island. I know that. So for you, we turn let air in. Every listener in New York is like, what is this man talking about? Okay. I don't know what that means. What if,
Jason, do you have these kind of slow combustion fires in Ireland?
Yeah, we call them log burners. I don't know what slow combustion fire seems very long-winded.
Okay, well, that's what we call them here in Australia. I don't know what you
what
guys
call them. You guys live on an island here? I'm in Sumatra, so I'm here with any. But anyways, no. Just for everybody in America, they have no idea what we're talking. I have no idea what you're talking about. The point is, anyway. you could set everything to go before Shabbos. You can't adjust and manipulate it when Shabbos starts, but you can ignite it and let it go full throttle throughout Shabbos.
When I wake up in the morning on Shabbat morning and it's still cooking away, it's still really, really hot, the embers are burning in there and it's keeping the house warm, that's fine, right?
Oh, yeah. Anything you do before Shabbos can go right through Shabbos, not a problem at all. Enjoy it all you'd like to.
Okay.
Now, one thing I want to announce, this is very important, and that is and this is critical for every listener to know who are planning on keeping Shabbos, that if there is a danger to human life, meaning let's say someone's in someone's sick and they need to light a fire for someone whose life is in danger, not only are you allowed to violate the Shabbos, but you must violate, if you're, God forbid, your child is, God forbid, sick and you need to drive to the hospital because your child has 104 temperature, we do not say, well, I'm going to be really religious and I'm not going to, you know, no, you have to. So that's very important. There are three cardinal sins which we never which we would rather give our lives than violate, but Shabbos is not one of them. But in all other cases, we don't kindle the fire on the Shabbos. Hey, we don't ignite it. We don't begin it because that is the malacha. That is what God did. So, for example, on day four, God created the sun, but the sun keeps going over Shabbos. But it's like, yes, however, that I didn't pay attention that day in astronomy, but whatever, or astrology, whatever it is, didn't pay attention to that. But the point
hydrogen,
is, whatever, it's going. That's the key. Okay.
That's the key.
I know there's astrology and astronomy. I was just kidding.
It's one
everybody
of those.
Who thinks I'm an idiot out there? I know the difference. I did it to make sure you're awake, okay? So,
all right. Now it goes on. Cool. So Moses spoke to the congregation of Israel, saying, this is the thing which the Lord commanded, saying, take from among you an offering to the Lord. Whoever is of a willing heart, let him bring it as an offering to the Lord. Gold, silver, bronze, blue, and purple, and scarlet thread, fine linen, and goat's hair, ram skin, dyed red. I've still got badger skin here, Jason. Anyway. And acacia wood, oil for the light, and spices for the anointing oil and the sweet incense, onyx stones and stones to be set in the ephod and the breastplate. I've got a question, and this is... Hey, well, before you jump in,
Wait. My last name starts with an S, which I think comes before V. I don't remember exactly. I forgot first grade, and Mrs. Applebaum, but I think she said that S, as in singer, comes before Vander something.
Fine.
No, I'm kidding. Go ahead. You go ahead. What's your question?
No. Well, in a previous Torah portion, Ross and I were discussing this. We didn't have an answer for this. We're hoping maybe you can help us out. Shatnez, right? Yes. We're talking about wool and linen mixed together. Forbidden for people to wear. Is that because we couldn't figure this out. Is it because it is it's part of the priest's garment that he is allowed to wear it because it's a holy mixture, a holy material that's the reason why ordinary people are not allowed to wear it? Because there seems to be some verses that suggest that is the case. What's your understanding of that?
It doesn't suggest that's the case. It is the case. And,
really?
And yes. So just to but here's the point. I want to be very careful here. With the prohibition of wearing any clothing made of wool and linen. Be careful, my friends, because fine clothing. Now, Jason and Jono don't have this problem because they walk around in blue jeans all day. But I'm talking for those who have decent clothes. No, actually, we saw Jason has a fancy. The key is that we're not allowed to wear that, but that is what's called a chok. A chok means a commandment which has no obvious reason for it. Torah is silent on the reason. There are commandments that Torah tells us why. Torah doesn't tell us why, but it's very clear that things that are kodesh, that are holy, are separate. And in fact, the garment used by the high priest was made of, specifically of shatness, of this admixture. So one could easily, could extrapolate, because there's a convergence, because we see that Hashem wanted to set aside this admixture for only the high priest, and people in their ordinary clothing could not mix with it. That's correct. So that is the juxtaposition, and it's very clear. The Torah is screaming that this is set aside only for the high priest. Now, go ahead.
I'm just saying that's news to me. I'm fascinated by that. I didn't know that. Jason, what's going through your mind?
I just wanted to remind people that I'm imagining next year or the year after, and someone comes to this program and they start listening to us speaking, and they hear the text, and they're like, "Well, we've heard this before." And maybe we've tuned into the wrong program. But a lot of the texts that we're going to go through now, we have gone over already. And this is like a kind of a recap.
There is a bit of repetition.
Yeah.
This is sort of a recap, yeah.
The verse we've just read about the take for yourselves an offering of the Lord, every generous-hearted person shall bring it. Generous-hearted, I have in one of my translations. And I kind of like that translation, especially when I remember that as Westerners, if you like, when we think about our heart, that governs our emotion, and our head governs kind of rational thought. But when we read in the text a decision that's made with the heart, that's where rational thought came from for these mm-hmm. people. The head was something else, you know, that was for dreaming. But this is when they are generous hearted to give these gifts, that means they're generous minded. And I like that, because they've made the choice to be generous. It's not just a wishy-washy feeling. I thought that was worth bringing up.
That's a really good point, Toby.
I love that. In fact, that's the part that's brilliant. Now, but just so people know, the word is lev, nadiv libo, which is translated usually heart, but a heart is a pump. And it doesn't mean that the pump. So it does mean, as Jason said perfectly, this is the mind. The Torah is warning us here about misapprehending what is coming into view. And then Jason touched on two points, and that's precisely what I want to discuss, and really comment on Jason's both points. The mishap, the danger that may happen here is we may think that this is that God needs this stuff. That means, in fact, there is some 6 million Hindus here in Indonesia who believe that their gods actually need these offerings. It is the God has a need, and we're fulfilling the Hindus fulfill those needs, and in turn, the Hindu gods respond with the gifts that they have sovereignty over. Therefore, the language is very careful. That is, it's not like that the giving here is because God needs it, but rather than the div libo, it emerges from you. It's not because God needs it, but it actually raises your mind, and it raises your awareness and your experience and encounter with Hashem. And then the other part, what Jason said, is really very, very deep. And this is very big. So if I may take a moment, because this is going to help explain all the portions that we are about to encounter to the end of Exodus, even going through Leviticus and Numbers, and what we've been, because there's something very strange going on here. You've noticed that there's a lot of repetition. If you've been paying attention to the portions we have already studied, the portions that we are now encountering, you notice that there's a concentric circle here that is very obvious, and that is there's this enormous amount of discussion of God encountering the Jewish people with his cloud at Mount Sinai, his cloud at the tabernacle. We've had that cloud. We can go all the way back to Exodus chapter 25. We can sort of move in that concentric circle, almost like an archer's target, a circle within a circle. We can see there the discussion of the Shabbos over and over and over again. The Sabbath is coming up. I mean, just nonstop Shabbos, and to keep the Shabbos and to do the Shabbos, which is a very strange thing. I thought Shabbos is not doing anything. What do you mean do the Shabbos? So we see that here in the text. And then we see, again, within that, again, in another closing circle, meaning it's sandwiched together, we see the discussion of the tabernacle. One of the things I think that's very striking about the building of the tabernacle is that we really don't understand it. That means we're going to discuss the tabernacle. Much of this is new, but much of it is material that's been discussed before. It's sort of the sandwiching in together, but much of it does not make sense to us in our world. In contrast to the commandments, like we see after the Ten Commandments, Exodus 21, where you have the laws of torts and so on, and that all makes sense to our mind, but so much of what's going on here with the tabernacles really doesn't, is a world of purity and impurity. What is that? So it really seems to be everything we're going to see about building a tabernacle, just about everything, is quite otherworldly that's going on here. Now, Bang Zoom, in the center of all those concentric circles, is this disaster. And that's a disaster of the golden calf. That is like right bang in the middle of. What is coming into view here in all these portions, and in fact, I would just say personally that if you grasp this point, you really can get an understanding of what's going on here, is that we have circle within circle, before and after the cloud, before and after the tabernacle, before and after the Shabbat, and bang, a disaster in the middle of the golden calf. What is the connection? What's happening over here? One other point I will make to even heighten this conundrum is that, as it turns out, it is the juxtaposition. It's very clear the Torah is repeatedly juxtaposing the keeping the Shabbos next to the observance of the tabernacle, and it can't be any more unambiguous than in this chapter we're looking at now, in that we actually have here the language of the Shabbos of Melacha, that these are the day Shabbos, the keeping of Shabbos is abstaining from this thing, not called really work, but Melacha is this unique kind of work, but it's also the language that God uses when building the tabernacle, and that is the same exact word, Melacha. You're going to see that right through this chapter going into 21, 22. So what, and our sages learn from this very clearly, that all the things we have just read here, there are in fact 39 specific types of work. This doesn't mean work as in physics, but work as unique actions are forbidden on Shabbos. Those things which the Jews had to do in order to build the Mishkan are specifically those actions which are forbidden on the Shabbos day. And it's very, I think, clear to anyone that we could see the juxtaposition is obvious. It's very clear that the Torah is pressing them against one against the other, and I pointed that out. But obviously this raises a question. That is, we get the legal aspect of it. It's very clear God is saying they're same, using the same word, Melacha, but why is there a connection between the two? Why would building a tabernacle, and why would the because we're going to about to read a lot, and we'll go through it pretty quickly, because some of it really just you can read it, but like what this is otherworldly, like what does this Mishkan do, like how does it work? Well, but the key question is why would what is forbidden on Shabbos have anything to do with constructing of the tabernacle? And that's the point I wanted to make, because that's everything that's going on here.
So it says the following, I guess, 10 verses talk about the articles of the tabernacle. It says, all who are gifted artisans among you shall come and make all that the Lord has commanded. And it has an impressive list of the items that are to be there. Jason, what goes through your mind?
Yeah, it's kind of the same list that we've read off before, with a couple of exceptions. And it's just two things I want to point out while we're doing it. It would be a skippy bit, but as we haven't read them yet, it's a pre-skippy bit.
Okay.
So verse 12, because I really think we have to get through a lot, so we probably should kind of jump over some of the listy things. Verse 12, the ark and its poles, the ark covering and the screening dividing curtain. screening dividing curtain for me is the theme overriding the last two portions and this one and the next one. I think this whole tabernacle, the whole Mishkan, even the Shabbat is a screening dividing curtain. I think it's an awesome concept to have this division. But what's kind of cool is the word is used as hedge in other places. So if you'd like put a hedge between two boundaries, it has very specific purposes. You know, then you can't see through it. It's a clear division. And here in Ireland and in the UK, they're running campaigns to try and keep hedges in the countryside because the countryside is kind of dying. The animals haven't got anywhere to live, and we're not getting any wild flowers. And the hedges in themselves have their own purpose. So Job, for example, Job 1:10 mentions the same word for hedge as we have here for a dividing curtain. I think that's really important. The other thing was in verse, I think it was 18, and it mentions the pegs of the Mishkan and the pegs of the courtyard and their ropes. It's the first time the ropes get a mention. So in the first time we ran through this list, ropes aren't there, but now they are. And I just think that's kind of interesting that they weren't, and now they are.
Yeah. So now maybe we can bring this all together. We can now have a picture of what's happening. You know, when we think about the Shabbos, we think for us, Shabbos is celebrating that God created the world on 6 days and resting on the seventh day, meaning he stopped creating on the seventh day. So when we think about Shabbos, we think about that's really the big deal. That means God created the world. For us, that's like, wow. And he created the world very specifically according to our physical needs. What I think that is difficult for most of us to think about, or just sort of is not in our view, is that from God's vantage point, creating the universe was something unnecessary for him, meaning that what existed before the universe was created, what was there? There was just God. He didn't need any of these things. It was just God. And in order for God to create the universe, in a sense, he needed to sort of, it's in Hebrew it's called simsum, but he had to create a space for the universe with all its perfect laws and so on to accommodate that universe. He had to retract himself, in essence, so there could be free will for the purpose of all mankind, and that is so that he could choose, he can have free will, and God does that out of love, and he creates this human being that is created, that is B'Tselem Elokim, which means he's created in God's image. So if I may say this differently, God created, which he did need, a home for mankind on 6 days, and then he rested on the seventh. He created a home for man in God's home, in God's big universe, which we can't relate to because it's completely spiritual. God doesn't need any laws of nature. He created a home for man. In turn, what God is asking us to do is, because we are created in his image, God is saying to man, create a home for me. Create a home for me that is not based on your laws or logical, rational laws, but is based on spiritual laws, and I'm going to give you the instructions of how to create such a home. And it's because you are creating the image of God, and this goes to the point that Jason just made, and that is the people who are given the instructions how to make it. It's because you're creating the image of God, and it isn't an accident, I don't think, that the person who was the great, the person who builds, who's given the wisdom and understanding to build this home, his name is Bezalel. And what is really Bezalel? Bezalel really is a contraction or maybe an acronym for two words, and that is B'Tselem Elokim, in the image of God. So what we have is a back and forth. God creates a universe that he doesn't need, but he does it out of his love, and he puts man at the center of it. Man is creating the image of God. Man, in turn, then is creating a house for God, on our, in our universe, in our place, and therefore in the, because God, when he created the universe, he created it in 6 days, and he stopped creating the universe on the seventh, he stopped all creation. We, in turn, when we create the tabernacle, we may not build it on Shabbos, and there's one juxtaposition. But the other thing is, we have to imitate God in that all those things that God did to create the universe, all those things that he was doing, now all those things that you do to create God's house, his universe, so to speak, on our universe, we also refrain from doing at the very same time. And that's the connection there is so striking. And that's why the language is the same. And that's why we learn out from there, we derive from there, that all the things that God, that all the things that are unique to building the Mishkan, the tabernacle, are prohibited on the Shabbos day. And there's your connection, why they all spin together. The golden calf, one may say, was really a failed attempt at by mankind to really try to build their own form of a tabernacle, mm-hmm. meaning to build your Jesus, in a sense, in that you are now, instead of doing it by God's rules, but in your alarm and shock, in your haste, because you thought Moses was gone and dead and he's finished, what the Jews did was, instead of listening to God and said, God is not a... No, the Jews went and built something. So in the way that we think it should be, and perhaps a golden calf would be that thing which we'd like to look at, but no, it has to be according to the way I say, not the way you say.
So from verse 20, it says, "And all the congregation of the children of Israel departed from the presence of Moses. Then everyone came whose heart was stirred, and everyone whose spirit was willing, and they brought the Lord's offering for the work of the tabernacle of meeting, for all its service, and for the holy garments." Jason, verse 22.
Jono, will you tell me what you've got for verse 22?
Sure. Well, it says, "They came, both men and women, as many had a willing heart, and they brought, I've got earrings and nose rings, rings and necklaces I've got, jewelry of gold," and that is every man who made an offering of gold to the Lord. What have you got?
You don't have buckles in there anywhere?
I don't have buckles.
That's interesting. I've got bracelets, earrings, rings, and buckles. And I'd like Tovia, if possible, to tell me what it says in the Hebrew and then to explain what a buckle is.
So you have over here. So you have there. It's really a very strange word, but it really means like body ornaments that if you look at the strange language that the men will come with the women, which is odd, we see that these are, that not only were women at the forefront of donating it, but these kinds of jewelry were jewelry that women were probably going to bring more of than men were, because these are unique to women.
That's not good enough.
That's not good enough at all.
I'll tell you what I have in my polite version of this. It says that girdles, Hebrew kumaz, is a in here it's a bracelet, but I'm sorry, it's a buckle, but it's a girdle. Now my Rashi commentary said that this is a golden ornament placed over a woman's private parts, and so it's more than likely to be a metallic
girdle.
Well,
it's some
girdle.
Kind of chastity belt.
I don't know, but I've never read that before, and I found that was kind of interesting.
Tovia,
yes.
What's he talking about?
So I'm looking at Rashi right over here. So Rashi says here, Hamuz, clay zov, who they are vessels that are made out of gold. So that's what Rashi says, that these are ornaments that women would wear specifically to cover themselves. Everybody is, the commentaries are all very intrigued by the order of preference of who is most honored in these texts, and the food chain here, in a sense of who is most honorable, was the women, the giving up of ornaments that are unique to women to covering themselves. Men, you notice when Hanoshim, the women, men are coming al Hanoshim, which means like they're coming along with the women. That's very odd in the text. And we're going to see in a moment, you're going to keep reading, but you're going to see here that the Nesiim, that the heads of the sort of the heads of the leadership, they're going to come up later on because they actually were not nearly as forthcoming and as generous as the women were. In fact, the even the spelling of the word Nasiim is a put down because it is defective. And you'll see that in chapter in verse 27 and 28. And when I say defective, I mean that Hebrew words could be spelt with or without certain consonants and you'd have the same meaning. And when we have a defective word, which means without letters but with the same vowels, it's telling us there's something missing. You'll see that in just a moment.
Interesting. Well, so anyway, 22, that's a very curious verse. It goes on in 23, and every man with whom was found blue, purple, scarlet thread, fine linen, goat's hair, and red skins of rams and badger skins again, they brought them. Everyone who offered an offering of silver and bronze brought the Lord's offering, and everyone with whom was found acacia wood for any work of the service, they brought it. And all the women.
By the way, just I'm sorry, I'm jumping
please.
In, but
you're
I'm
right.
allowed to because what am I going to do? I'm not going to get a raise. What do I care? But again, you look at the word v'chol meleches ha'avodo heviu. Just to point out what had been said earlier, you see there, kol meleches. That's the same exact word as malacha. What is considered a violation of Shabbos? These are very strange words. You're going to see it later again. But I'm pointing out the Torah is going out of its way to use the word malacha, which is identical to the Shabbos. So that, okay, you may continue.
Well, thank you. It goes on in 25.
It just happens to be I take over shows. Go ahead.
All the women who were gifted artisans spun yarn with their hands and brought what they spun, the blue and the purple and the scarlet and the fine linen. And it goes on to say, and all the women whose hearts stirred with wisdom spun yarn of goat's hair.
We have already been introduced to men who have a certain wisdom and understanding. And so we have men, but when it comes with women, so we have women as well that are very involved in this. What is being conveyed here that they have unique knowledge and unique wisdom? What does that mean? They are, if I may, they are being asked to build like a spaceship. That means they're being asked to build God's home on earth. Mm. And therefore, it requires a special spiritual awareness. And this awareness, where did it come from? Who received this awareness? We saw Bezalel earlier receiving this awareness. This awareness came from someone who gave everything of themselves. Incidentally, going back in the early part of Genesis, who gave everything of themselves? It was Abel. And therefore, sacrifice was accepted by God. These are people who gave everything. And now, if we go into the very next verse, go ahead.
The rulers brought onyx stones.
So it says, Bahanasiyam, they come later, and you can see right away the Torah is sort of diminishing them a little bit. You see, Bahanasiyam normally is not spelt that way. I'll just teach the listeners a little grammatical rule, if I may. Whenever we have that E, which is indicated by one dot underneath the consonant, typically in Hebrew, it's followed by a yud. Okay, so typically the word Hanasiim, it could be spelled many ways, but usually you'd have a sin, which is a third to the last Hebrew letter, followed by a yud, which indicates that there's an E under the letter the consonant behind. And again, after the Aleph, we have that exact same chirik, that one dot, which is E sound, double E in pronunciation. And then again, you'd have the Yud Mem. Remember, we've talked about this 1,000 times. How do you say plural in Hebrew? It's Yud Mem, Im at the end. But notice again, so then the word Nasiim here is spelt in a way without those Yuds. What's very clear, what the Torah is trying to try is sort of messing on is the women really were at the forefront of this. The men followed, and the Nasiim really, they gave, but it's nowhere near as much of giving as we have the others. One other point should be made is, unlike the people giving for a count where it had to be an exact amount, here it's whatever you wish from your heart, the maximum. Mm. It's from you. It's not for God.
That's right. And they just kept giving. And it goes on in 29, the children of Israel brought a free will offering to the Lord. All the men and women whose hearts were willing to bring material of all kinds for the work which the Lord, by the hand of Moses, had commanded to be done. Okay, wow, silence. I'll keep reading. Okay, so...
Well, you dropped out a little bit for me. I was just waiting for it to pick back up.
Oh, did I?
Mean, but if you're recording yourself, it doesn't make a difference because you're going to be fine in the recording. You just sound
there's a thunder...
Yeah, you just sound like an idiot to us, but if you're in, it's fine.
There's a thunderstorm outside.
You're the guy
you
with
can't
the
hear the thunder, obviously.
We don't care.
Okay, so it goes on. The artisans called by God, we've got from verse 30, Moses said to the children of Israel. Now, you've already talked about Bezalel. Well,
this is where it comes in. Notice the language, sweethearts. Look over here. Vayomer Moshe el b'nei, let me, if I may, just do the Hebrew with you. Vayomer Moshe el b'nei Israel, and Moses said to the children of Israel, Ru'u, see, Korah Hashem, the Almighty called b'shem in the name Bezalel. So we see here, like, what is b'shem in the name? So here, remember what I said to you earlier, that we are, I'm going to use a word, but don't misunderstand it, we are little gods in a way. Pimen, not the Jews, meaning that we are unlike monkeys and dogs. We have a part of Hashem in us. What we, I do not know, and anyone tells you they know, don't listen to them. But in some way, which is incomprehensible, so we are created in the image of God, whatever that means, okay? Whatever that means, it means that we have to behave like God. In fact, there's a commandment like that. Kedoshim to you, you shall be holy. Why? It's a very strange reason.
Because I am holy.
Well, what is the connection? The connection is that you are God-like. In fact, we're called gods in the Bible. I mean, really, I feel goosebumps on my shoulders because I was diving a whole lot. I'm kidding. I feel because this is so. Just so you understand, sweet Kindleuch, we have an immortal soul. There is a God in us. In classical Jewish language, we have a neshama soul. It's chelek mimal mamish, which means it is a part of God that's inside of us, that's eternal, and only man has that, and angels do too, but angels are only supernal. We have the earth part of us as well, and we have free will. And therefore, look what's going on here, that we see Bezalel, that this name Bezalel is so important, in that Bezalel is a contraction of Bezalel Elokim. So Bezalel, in a sense, is Mr. Representative of mankind. You, mankind, Bezalel Elokim, have to create a house for me like I created a house for you. And also, just like I stop you, mankind, who are created in my image, I stop creating your house on the seventh day. I stop doing these kinds of things on the seventh day. I want you to stop building my house with the instructions that I use for that house on the seventh day, Mr. Bezalel, meaning Mr. Bezalel Elokim in the image of God. You see how delicious this all comes?
That's beautiful.
Yeah.
Now, verse 31, Tobia, we've read this before, and he has filled him with the Spirit of God in wisdom and understanding and knowledge and all manner of workmanship. But it goes on to say in verse 34, and he has put in his heart the ability to teach. What does that mean exactly?
Well, what's happening over here is that the ability to convey, remember, what does it mean? Now that we understand that, this is why I started this out and why this portion is so important. I started out by with the point, and that is we really cannot, we're building something that is otherworldly, okay? This is everything, this little point. We are building a place, a home for God, just like, I want you to listen, every listener very carefully, just like when God created the universe, along with, I don't know, atoms and electrons and so on, they have nothing to do with God, meaning God doesn't need any of those things. It's a universe fine-tuned especially for humanity. We are now building a tabernacle, a mishkan, that is based not on the natural laws, but on based on laws that don't belong to this world. Therefore, it requires, when shaping, because we have obviously a dearth of as much detail as you hear and see as you study the Torah, it is a dearth of, there's a lot of missing information. It requires a spiritual, almost prophetic know-how. How do you build God's universe based on laws that we have nothing to do with? None of these laws have anything to do with the laws that govern this universe that we can understand. And therefore, Hashem has to place a level of prophecy on people who are saying, I'm there. Obviously, God only uses special people for such a thing, to build a house that is not governed by our laws, natural laws, because it's God's universe.
So in I've got one English translation here that says, and he hath put in his heart that he may teach. It doesn't say ability. And I've got another one that says he's put in his heart the ability to teach. But that word ability is in brackets. Does it say ability in Hebrew, or does it say he put into his heart to teach?
Lahoros means to teach. It actually is the word to show. Lahoros means to demonstrate, to illustrate. Lahoros nosen belibo. He gave him the ability to be able to teach. That's the actual word. Word Lahoros, just, you know, there are many different ways to say teach. We might as well get a Lahoros means to illustrate, to demonstrate. There is a language of re'iyah there, a language of showing, illustrating.
Yeah, I was just asking because that, for me, they're two different things. So if someone put in my heart the ability to teach, then that would make me suddenly able to teach. But if someone gave me the heart to teach, that's a different thing. So one of my translations says it put it in his heart to teach, and one says put in his heart the ability to teach. And that's two different things. I just wanted to know which one was right.
So it's giving him the ability to teach, the ability to illustrate. To illustrate, right.
Okay. All right. And not just him, but
Who else?
Aholiab.
What does that mean? Oh. So let's break up that word, and then we can go splashing in Torah. We can really go crazy. So I just talked to about name Bezalel. Bezalel is the image of God, in the image of God. What does Aholiab mean? It's actually two ogedic contraction. What is an ohel? An ohel is a tent, right, which is what this is. And what does Av mean?
Father.
So that means that we have two people, Mr. Image of God man and Mr. the tent or home of God, of the Father man.
The Father.
Oh, you see what's happening? So we really are creating a house for Hashem, or the Father's house. And why are you doing it? Why not bears and monkeys? Because we are Bezalel. We are created the image of God. It works together so delicious. This is like explosions all over. So what's happening is that you man create a tabernacle for me, and don't blow it. Don't you dare. See, what do other religions do? I get the Greco-Roman world that had Hercules and Zeus. If you look at their pictures, they look beautiful. They have long hair. Zeus, I don't know how did this, had all these things. So don't do that. Like, don't create my universe according to your universe. That's the whole thing. Don't worship me. Don't create God in your image. I'm creating man. That's 13 Judaism and all these other religions. All these other religions are creating God in our image. Judaism says, no, man is created in God's image. And look at the two people here who are given divine inspiration to convey and teach about why do they need so much knowledge. The reason they need so much knowledge is they're creating a space. They're creating something otherworldly. And what is that otherworldly? This is the tent of God. And why you get to build the tent of God? Why not other creatures? Because you are Bezalel. You are created in the image of God. That's what's going on here.
That's really cool. And so it mentions a couple of times more that they are gifted artisans and with wisdom and so on and so forth. So they set about the work of putting it together.
But, now, again, the word there again, look at the word. The word is not avoda, meleches avoda, avodas hakodesh. And again, go back to Shabbos. Kol melachos lo yisasu. Don't do any work. But it's not work has many words for work. It's using the same exact word. We're building with the universe of God on earth, in this our universe, and therefore all the things that God and so on. You get all the connections. So the words there is
now,
the same.
Chapter 36, verse 4, and then all the craftsmen who were doing all the work for the sanctuary came, each from his work that he was doing, and they spoke to Moses, and they said, look, Moses, the people bring too much. They bring much more than enough for the service of the work which the Lord commanded us to do. So Moses gave a commandment, and they caused it to be proclaimed throughout the camp, saying, let neither man nor woman do any more work for the rest, for the offering of the sanctuary. And the people were restrained from bringing for the material that they had.
What's the message? What's the message?
It's too much.
But what's the you wouldn't, I don't want to, you wouldn't find this in other religions. They say, oh, no more tithing, guys. We have enough. I mean, no. What obviously is very striking here, you know, is that we don't, it's what is needed precisely for that amount, and no one is looking to make a fortune, or there can be no corruption here. This has to be pure. If we don't, we have enough money that we need to stop, and we're going to see in Pukude, in fact, that inventory is taken, even though great men are here, but there's going to be inventory taken just to illustrate that everything is done pure and straight. And if once we have enough money, stop building and stop giving. We've got enough.
So this is what follows is basically the building of the tabernacle all the way to the end of chapter 36. Is there anything you'd like to highlight here, Tobia?
No. This is everything. Everything you see here is all about the building of the Mishkan, which is a place of Shekhinah, same word, where it rests. And also, be aware, the word Mishkan also is the name of the roof of this tent, the lowest layer is called the Mishkan. That's the that's also the name. So don't confuse. You'll see that coming up twice. You'll see that talk. It's a sort of a. It means two things. It either means the entire construction, but it also means the lowest of the three layers that are on top of this portable temple.
From chapter 37, it kicks off with the making of the Ark of the Testimony, and we've got the details there. Of course, we've already mentioned that neither the word mercy nor the word seat. There's no mercy seat there, but I've got it here in the New King James. Anything you would like to highlight here, Toby?
Yeah, this is the big one. This is the big.
Yeah,
this is
huge.
Let me first do the atom bomb. Which, when I say atom bomb, I take it back. What I mean is, let me just give you the biggest part of the picture. Just like, let's think of, remember what we now come into view, that the tabernacle will building a home for God. That means, how does God be among us? Well, we talked about his cloud being us. It's on God's terms. But if you'll notice, here we have the most intimate. Here we finally have the purpose of the whole tabernacle. Here we have the glory, the goal of all these very special things that we find inside these special vessels. Meaning, just like when God created the universe. So we talked about this in our first show together on this. He created fish. Fish, mm-hmm. He doesn't talk about fish anymore. It's not that important. Fish is only ancillary to the big thing, the most important vessel that goes inside of the universe. That's mankind. So look at chapter 37 of Exodus. Look at the passages we're looking at now and realize, whoa, this is the really important. This is the Ark of the Covenant. Here is the menorah. Here is the shulchan. I'm holding back a lot for later portions of why everything's placed where it is. There's a reason for it. But what is most striking about here is this is correlates really to day six in the afternoon of creation of the universe. That means this is the most central features. The outer parts, of course, are very important. You can't have a man without earth, without water, without all the other things. But the end of it, this correlates to, this is the center of everything. So here we have the Shulchan, the menorah, and so on.
So last time we spoke about the Ark of the Covenant, it was with Ross. Tovio, let me ask you, do you have an opinion on where it is?
Well, anybody who tells you that they know where it is, that means they don't know where it is.
Okay.
So just get that point out of the way.
Oh, hang on a minute. Are you telling me you don't know where it is?
I think there's a very good in fact, when we are in the land of Israel doing our tour together, I will point to the spot where there's a consensus of where it's very likely to be, and that would logically would be in the city of David, which is south of the Temple Mount, which is that's where it's likely. And in fact, there have been some testing done by a sweet man, Davidullah. Maybe we'll get to meet him, but he was one of the founders and builders the man who uncovered the city of David, which is archaeologically, my friends, is the most rich area.
It's absolute gold mine.
I don't want to say, because what's the point? What it is, that's where, I mean, that's really archaeology. So there are tunnels we're going to be moving through, and there's stone going straight up, just straight up stone. So they have used the sonar to try to find, and they have found that there is, in these stone walls, there are spaces. Okay.
There are cavities.
Now, everyone's going, I know there's somebody in South Carolina, so why don't take out a drill and bust through the wall and find out? Okay. So I'd like to answer that question now.
Please.
In case anyone brings dynamite on our tour, don't bring dynamite. Leave your drills at home, you Texans. Because the reason this is all delicate work is the people who do this archaeology, these holy people, they are not allowed to bust through anything, because this, everything in the city of David, everything in all these places is very holy, sacred, and you know, the only thing they're allowed to do is they're allowed to use their hands or very delicate tools to gently pull away the earth to uncover what's there. But you can't just bust through stone. So just to understand, the only thing they can do is they can use certain instruments, high technology instruments, to try to penetrate, figure out what's behind the stone. But they can't, like, just, this is not Ohio, my friends, okay? So they can't bust it. But that's, I mean, logically, also, where would someone at the end of the first temple, how would you carry it? Where would you put it? So that's south. It also is physically, the city of David is way below the Temple Mount physically. So I mean, it's logically where it would be placed, but, you know, we don't.
Do you think it will resurface one day? I mean, I know it says, what is it, in Jeremiah, I think.
In Jeremiah.
It'll no longer come to mind.
No, right. So that's different. What Jeremiah is saying is different. When Jeremiah is talking about the Messianic Age, you will not say, you know, the Ark of the Covenant and so on. It doesn't mean there won't be an Ark of the Covenant. That's not what he has in mind. Jeremiah is saying that in the Messianic Age, the major function of the Ark of the Covenant, what was the most visible, striking thing? Because no one was allowed to see it. It was in this surrounded thing that you couldn't see it. So when was it unleashed? When was the Ark of the Covenant sort of taken out? Well, it was taken out when the Jews went to war. When they went to war, the Ark of the Covenant was at the forefront of the Jewish people, and that's how they went to war. So what Jeremiah is saying is not that they won't have an Ark of the Covenant. The context and what's conveyed is Messianic. In the Messianic Age, you're not going to war. So that major function won't be there. But it stands to reason that there'll be an Ark of the Covenant there, of course. Of course, we'd have the restoration of Luchos. Jeremiah means it won't be going to war anymore. That's what Jeremiah means there. You know, just like he says, don't say the temple, Lord, doesn't mean the temple doesn't have a role. We just realize that, you know, it's a different kind of context, but that's the way Jeremiah spoke.
Right. Fair enough. Jason.
Tovia said, if anyone says they know where the Ark of the Covenant is, then chances are they don't really know. And then he said, he doesn't really know where it is, which tells me he does know where it is. That's all I'm going to say.
So that's really, this whole show really superficially is about the portion of the week, but the real purpose of the show is, what does Tovia really know?
What does he know?
Yeah, what is it superficially about the portion of the week? Let's get into his frontal lobe.
What's going on? Deductive reasoning of Jason.
Where would Jeremiah put it? Like an A lot? I mean, it's like, this is not, but we don't know. Whatever.
There's people that say that, yeah, I mean, you mentioned that we're going to Israel. Just for people that don't know, we are going to Israel in November. You can come with us. There is still places on the bus at the moment. You can secure one with a deposit if you go to truthtoyou.org, and click on the Israel tour link there. You'll see it there, and follow the instructions. Now, Jason's going, Ross is going, Toby is going, I'm going, and we'll all be going through the Temple Tunnel Tour, the Temple Mount Tunnel Tour as well, the Western Wall Tunnel Tour. And I've heard people say, you know, it's somewhere down there. It's somewhere underneath the Temple Mount. But you're saying that it's in the City of David. So it's just, you know, it's going to be amazing to be able to go to these places and speculate as to where it may actually be.
There is a legend, I don't know, but I'll do this legend in 90 seconds. And that is, in the early part of the 20th century, there was a Jew, this is a legend, but a strong and very well-known legend, that someone, a Jew working in Jerusalem, discovered the Ark of the Covenant, And at the time, in the early 20th century, the greatest rabbinic giant was the Chafetz Chaim. And a message was sent to him asking what should be done, and he said to cover it over because it's not to be revealed now. That's a very, it's more than legend, but that's a very well-known story. I'll just leave it there, a story. But that's
wow,
it.
Okay.
That's what we know. But that is, everybody who's decent knows that story. I'm kidding. It's very well known.
That's cool. So it goes on to talk about, let's see. Okay, so we've got the table for the showbread. We have spoken about that in the past. Of course, the golden lampstand, the menorah, yes. The altar of incense, and the making of the anointing oil. You guys, is there anything you would like to highlight in the rest of
there
chapter 37?
Jason has nothing to say. I'll be speaking on his behalf. Okay. No, I'm just kidding. I'm going to wait, because there is a reason why everything is placed where it is. It's going to relate to what we said, but it's coming up so big in portion later that I'm going to restrain it. But obviously, what is most striking, and only things that matter are the things that I say, and that is, what is most central is here we have, like man, this is everything here. These are the centerpieces of the tabernacle.
Chapter 38 continues on with the making of the altar.
One thing to jump in with there very quickly.
Go on.
I've never considered it before, but the text kind of insinuates that the altar was hollow. I always assumed it was kind of solid and sturdy, and there was a case of wood, and then they put the metal on afterwards. But when I read in this translation, it says that the sides of the altar, which he made hollow out of boards, and so it kind of gives the impression that it was more easier to carry that way. So that makes sense to me, actually. You know, rather than carrying around a ton of wood, why not make a really solid structure that's hollow?
Similar to the poles, which were hollowed out and obviously pulled down so it could be carried, right?
If we do get a chance to go to the Temple Institute, we're going to see models of these, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, they reproduced it based on all the laws, and we're definitely going to see.
Let's hope that we make time for that. It continues on the making of the bronze laver as well, of course, for the washing of the hands and the feet. I thought this was a really interesting thing. Again, the bronze mirrors of the serving women who assembled at the door of the tabernacle of meeting.
Do notice that we see, why is there so much emphasis placed on giving things that you use to make yourself beautiful and now give it over the tabernacle? That's the big thing. That means mirrors, that's what was used for copper. They didn't have in the old days glass with, I guess they used some sort of silver behind it to make mirrors. What the Torah wants you to get is that the Jews are making it right. Because remember the first thing when they had the golden calf? Remember I explained to you that these are very connected. The golden calf was the wrong way to put God in your midst. That's the wrong way. That's what's happening here. This is the right way to put God in your midst. And that is not according to your brain, but according to God's infinite mind. So that's what's happening here, saying all the things you use to beautify yourself, they're now being given over. Remember the mourning that they took off all their things?
Yeah, they took them. They took them all off. And so I guess they see. It seems like they see the opportunity to make right, because after all, the thing that got them into the trouble was the earrings in the first place. They took out all their earrings. They gave them to Aaron. They made the golden calf, and there it was. Now God says, "Now take off all your ornaments, you guys." Angry with you, and so they take off all their ornaments. Now they seem really quick to, like, you know, here are the ornaments, get rid of them, we don't want to make that mistake again. In fact, let's use them for something positive, let's use them for something holy, let's use them for something good that's going to please God and make good.
Right. That's very critical you said, because that was, if I ask anyone the question, when was the shift? God went from being so angry, wanted to destroy the Jewish people, where God is going, all right, I can work with this. Was terrible. This is a horrible thing that happened in our marriage, but I see that this marriage can be saved. It was at that moment the Jews took off their ornaments in a state of mourning. Now, once God said, and God then says, oh, that was a really good thing you did. He acknowledges this, you did good, and now our marriage is salvageable. Now that we've done that, now let's use those ornaments for something completely positive, and instead of you idiots who use it to build me in your midst with your dumb golden calf. And golden calf, I imagine, looked great. I mean, a gold calf must have looked terrific and very striking. But that's man inventing his own religion. Mm-hmm. Now, no, stop it. Now, use your gold and silver and your silver, your copper ornaments that you use for mirrors. use it now for thing. And the women, of course, are forefront in this. And our sages have a tradition, in fact, that in fact is because of righteous women, the Jewish people were worthy of salvation. All through the women are saving the Jewish people.
Mm-hmm. And so the final passage of our Torah portion of chapter 38 from verse 9 to verse 20 is all about the making of the court of the tabernacle. Anything to highlight here, guys? Jason, have you got something?
I might have. I'm just trying to find the...
Look at your notes.
Where are we up to? Is it 38.9? I may have skipped ahead.
What are you doing? Your nails? You putting a lipstick? What was your...
From 38.9 to 38.20. I mean, I can read it all through, but it's just, you know, there's the sockets and the hooks and the sockets and the hooks and the sockets and the hooks and the pillars and the sockets and the hooks and the glue.
It's literally just sockets and hooks until we get to 21.
It pretty much is, yeah. Tovia.
No, we could skip and move on from here. I probably cut this part out and just move on.
Okay, so that's it for the Torah portion.
Get a song, put that in here, that'd be fine.
I'm playing the Truth to You music as we speak, as we go out here, soothing everybody. And we're going to be returning again next week. Next week, because it's a double portion this week. Next week, I don't know what it's next week. This week, people, don't let me confuse you. It's Peku Day, which is Exodus chapter 38, 21, all the way to the end, which is chapter 40, verse 38. And until then, dear listeners, be blessed, be set apart by the truth of our Father's word. Shalom.